Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. Happy New Year. This week on the show, I don't even know where to start. The world has gone to shit. We're saying the S word in the first 10 seconds of the podcast. CES is almost here, so we're going to give you a preview. And we're going to talk about some new Motorola phones that have been announced and some new Samsung phones that are going to be announced next week. And then at the end of the show, we will talk about what's making us happy, because God knows we all need something to lift our spirits right now. Joining me, Jerry, Ara, and Joe. I don't even need to introduce you the way I used to, because it's a new year, it's a new podcast. What's going on? How are you, all of you?
I'm dying of cedar allergies. How are y'all?
You're dying of cedar allergies. What does that mean?
I came home for a few weeks to be around people again for a little while at the holidays, and Texas has something called mountain cedar, and I am highly allergic, and it has been torture. Like, I've been stuck in this house for the majority of the 3 weeks that I've been here, not that I was going to go much of anywhere anyway, but I can't even, like, go outside and go on a walk without just getting horrible, horrible allergies. I'm having to wear my mask inside whenever I'm not eating or sleeping to try and keep my allergies in check.
That's remarkable. I can't believe it, because it's January, so here everything just shuts down. Including allergies.
Oh, no. Mountain cedar isn't always like a December to February thing down here, which sucks.
Yeah. Even the cedars here in the Appalachians, they bloom in the middle of winter.
Yeah, the Kennedy has really bad cedar, or I guess her allergy is more pine, but there's still a lot of pine trees and stuff around here. And if you just drive around, it gets to the point where it's just like she does not do good with that stuff.
Yeah, you'll drive past some roads and it'll be like, oh, what's that dust cloud? Oh, crap, that's cedar pollen. No, no.
The pollen and essential oils of any plant are fine with me.
My immune system attacks everything, so they're not fine with me.
Jerry, I just think that the fact that you find a way to bring up that topic almost every podcast makes... That's what's making me happy this week.
Well, good.
Your ability to make subtle references to drugs.
I'd love a good pothead joke.
Me too. Okay, so let's start with the non-tech stuff. Or it's not non-tech, but it's not phone related. And then we'll get to the phone stuff a bit later. So unless you've been living under a rock for the last few days, you know, the year started out with a bang.
Literally.
And we had rioters, insurrectionists, mob, whatever euphemism for domestic terrorists you want to use, run up and take over the Capitol building yesterday. Donald Trump didn't say much of anything. And as a result, in fact, he encouraged it.
I was going to say, he said plenty yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't say much of anything to quell the riots is what I mean. And as a result, Facebook removed that video, removed a bunch of his posts from earlier in that day. And then Zuckerberg this morning, we're recording this on January 7th, issued a statement saying that Trump is banned indefinitely, and at least until Joe Biden's inauguration, which is now been processed and is official and will happen on the 20th. So Facebook did this thing and people like it. Twitter has not banned Trump, but they have suspended his account for 24 hours unless he voluntarily removes that video and two other inflammatory tweets.
12 hours. It's 12 hours from whenever he removes the three tweets in question, which we don't know if he's done it or not. So we have no clue when that's going to run out.
Right. So as of recording, though, he's still not back on Twitter. Snapchat, Twitch, Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, Shopify, they've all banned Trump or Trump campaign-related accounts. So this is a big deal, right? YouTube hasn't really done anything as far as I can tell, but there's no Trump.
Yeah, they took down the quote-unquote video of him calling for the rioters to stop. He uploaded that. I don't know if it was his channel or not, but I know that was taken down.
Yeah, the Rose Garden taped nonsense.
Where he told him he loved him.
The bigger thing from YouTube was that they said, okay, if you upload anything from now on that continues to spout these falsehoods about the election, that is a strike against your channel.
But that was also a policy implemented in 2020, right? This isn't brand new as of today.
No, that was, they forbid the upload of stuff, but it didn't, it wasn't necessarily a strike. So they're going a step further than they did before.
I see. Yeah. So in, now instead of just removing it, they remove it and it's a mark. What do you get? Two tries at YouTube before they just stop you from posting it altogether?
Yeah. I want to say it's two or three strikes and you're out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's happening. And the fallout from that has been swift, right? A lot of people on the right are decrying that social media platforms are abusing their power, free speech, First Amendment, blah, blah, blah. That none of that actually applies because these are private companies. They don't have to follow the First Amendment. You sign up for Twitter or Facebook and you have to accept their terms of service and they can do whatever they want because they're protected under Section 230. And a lot of the discourse over the last few weeks, which we've spoken about at length, and our friends at The Vergecast have spoken about it much better than we have, are, you know, you can't repeal Section 230. That opens up a massive amount of liability to all these social media platforms. However, we are going into a presidency where even Joe Biden is claiming that he wants to repeal parts of Section 230. So it'll be very interesting to see now that Trump has actually been suspended from both, from the two biggest social media platforms in the world. And I'm not talking about Twitter. I'm actually talking about Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, which is much smaller than both of those, plus Snapchat and Twitch and all the others. What this is going to mean for moderation on social media going forward. So that's one thing. And we can talk about that in a second. But there's another part of today where this just happened to, you know, come into effect today. WhatsApp now requires that you share your data with Facebook, except if you're in the EU, which is protected under the GDPR. So, Jerry, I want to talk about this as well, because it feels like Facebook is kind of giving and taking in one fell swoop, right? They did this, they did something pretty admirable and, you know, timely with banning Trump when it was necessary. But this has been a long time coming. The integration of Facebook with Instagram and WhatsApp is finally bearing fruit for the company. And now that WhatsApp has updated its privacy policy, you basically are going to share a specific amount of information with Facebook, which wasn't happening before. Walk us through what Facebook gets out of this, right? It's obvious. You know, before they were getting nothing from WhatsApp users, and now they're getting a certain amount of data. But why is it important for WhatsApp, just at a high level, for Facebook rather, to get WhatsApp data from its users?
Well, luckily, longtime Android nerds will know the name Super Curio. His name's Francois Simond. You can find him on Twitter at Super Curio. You should totally follow him. He is pretty enraged about this and has broken it all down. The third item on their list says that they require you to accept this data sharing. So they require you to accept this data collection so they may share it with unspecified third parties for unspecified purposes. That's where Facebook, that's the money right there. You know, I use T-Mobile as a phone service. I know T-Mobile sells my data because my daughter also uses T-Mobile, has the same last name as me, and happens to live in Georgia. Do you know how many texts I have received reminding her to go vote yesterday? I'm talking thousands of robo-texts. And my wife gets them because she uses T-Mobile. My other daughter uses T-Mobile, also gets them. All signed to my one child that lives in Georgia. That's because T-Mobile sells your data. We know that. That's, you know, legislators have looked at that and, you know, decided they don't like that practice. That's what Facebook wants to do. They're not going to decrypt your encrypted chats and, you know, tell somebody what you said. But they want to be able to tell retailers where you are when you're at Target. They literally are going to require, they're going to remotely turn on your GPS. That's, you know, your geolocation via IP address and GPS and cell tower data. And they want that information so they can make lists out of it and sell it to advertisers. They're not the only company that does this. Your carrier does it. You know, there was a time where people used to think Google does it. That's not quite how it works with Google. They will gladly take an advertiser's money because they have that list. But the result is the same. But this is a big cash grab for Facebook. So many people use WhatsApp, and it's on your phone, and it's the type of app that's always alive. So it's always collecting some sort of data. And Facebook can take that data to keep track of where you are. So people that want to be able to present you with, you know, a notification in your status bar for the Walmart app, as soon as you hit that Walmart parking lot, they want to let you know that, you know, Portland cement is on sale if you've bought Portland cement before. It's weird how it all works, but it's also simple how it all works. They keep track of what you do when you're in a certain place, and they track your habits and sell ads. And Facebook, whether you know it or not, is an ad company. So,
I mean, people know.
Yeah.
I think people know
it's,
what Facebook
is. It's no longer, you know, talk with your friends from college. Facebook is now, what, the second largest ad company in the world behind Google? Or are they even,
I mean, they
bigger
split
than
the
Google?
Difference. I think they're bigger than Google in a lot of ways, but I think Google overall sells more of their revenue comes from ads than Facebook.
So that's why this is illegal under the GDPR, because it does this without your consent. In the background, it can do this at will, instead of a pop-up each time asking you to do this, which is great. Thank goodness for the GDPR. I wish we had something similar here in the States. Is it super nefarious? No. It's not anything to do with what you say over WhatsApp. Facebook doesn't care what you say over WhatsApp unless a judge sends them a subpoena and you happen to, you know, talk, you know, unencrypted somehow, they'll comply. But it's an invasion of your privacy all the same. And I don't like it. I don't like it at all.
Yeah, from my perspective, I guess on one end, like, I guess if I'm looking at WhatsApp and it's like, I know that is a Facebook-owned company, so I guess in the back of my mind it was always kind of like, something's bound to happen where Facebook is going to want to, they're going to want deeper integrations or more information or something, just because they have millions of people using this platform. And if they can learn more from them and profit from them somehow, like, they're obviously going to do that. Like, it is still really scummy for people that I like signed up for WhatsApp and started using it before Facebook bought it, or didn't know Facebook bought it. Or if you just are in a place where that's the platform your family and friends use, and like, you logistically, like, It doesn't make sense to leave it just because that's where your people are. Like, it is really shitty for those people that are either blindsided by this or just don't want anything to do with Facebook and are maybe not so entrenched in this stuff and couldn't have ever envisioned something like this happening to them.
And that's the part that, you know, I'll use the word anger, angers me the most, is people have been using WhatsApp long enough. All their family and friends use WhatsApp. That's how they communicate with each other. Now, all of a sudden today, hey, guess what? You either let us track your location data in real time and sell that information, or you can delete your account. That's a really crappy choice.
And saying to those people, oh, why don't you just use Telegram or Signal isn't really viable. If you have so many contacts and so many family members, getting everyone to migrate to a new platform at the snap of a finger isn't going to happen, either for people that don't want to or people in your groups that don't care about this stuff. Like, that's not a solution you can just tell people to go out and do.
Yeah. I told my kids and my wife, if they want to talk to me, they have to use Signal from now on. That lasted about a month and they didn't talk to me at all.
I mean, that's what happened when I moved from an iPhone to predominantly using Android phones. I had to disconnect from iMessage. So even when I went back to using an iPhone, I didn't re-enable iMessage. And it affected my group chats in particular, right? Because I have a lot of, yep. I had a lot of group chats that were ongoing and they didn't want to have green bubbles in their MMS messages, right? They just wanted straight up iMessage group chats. And as iMessage has become more entrenched in the US and Canada, and as it's added more features that are group message specific, there's no way that they would have moved away from iMessage. And it's the same thing with WhatsApp, right? People are comfortable with WhatsApp. What's interesting here though, Jerry, is that there's so many facets to this, right? Facebook is being sued by the FTC for an illegal monopoly. It is, part of that lawsuit is scrutinizing its purchase mainly of Instagram, but of WhatsApp as well. And they're claiming that the Facebook acquisition of WhatsApp was not scrutinized nearly as much and are trying to go back and retroactively undo some of the damage. And part of that remedy, if it goes that far, could be to break up WhatsApp and Instagram from Facebook.
Right.
Now, one thing that Facebook is doing to prevent this from happening is by unifying the back-end messaging framework. And they've done this through making Instagram DMs part of the Facebook Messenger infrastructure. So now Facebook Messenger is end-to-end encrypted. You can import your Facebook Messenger DMs into Instagram and vice versa, right? So this is now unified. And if you've used Instagram DMs in the last 6 months, you know that it looks a little bit different. It's an opt-in, so you don't necessarily have to, but like the WhatsApp privacy sharing with Facebook, that was an opt-in from 2016 until today. And as of February 8th, that won't be the case. So let's talk about that, because I was working here at Android Central when WhatsApp initially started sharing data with Facebook, right? This is not the first time. Now it's just that you don't have a choice. You could opt out, and we had a how-to that was on the site. I remember the day we wrote that how-to, how to opt out of data sharing between WhatsApp and Facebook. It like broke the internet. There were so many people who wanted to learn how to do that. But that's just not possible as of February 8th. So you're going to be sharing your profile name, your profile picture, your IP address, your phone number and contact list, your app logs, and your status messages with Facebook. And as Harish, who wrote up a really good explainer, says on the site, this is really completely counter to what the WhatsApp co-founders espoused when they were running the company, and they left 2 years ago because they were fighting with Zuckerberg and co. about data sharing.
The conspiracy theorist in me says Facebook is going to do as much as they can before this summer when, you know, some sort of judiciary committee forces them to divest WhatsApp.
Oh, they're not going to be forced to divest WhatsApp.
I know, but let my conspiracy theories work their little magic.
Let us dream, Bader. Let us dream of a better world.
But the more sane part of me says this is why they wanted WhatsApp in the first place. They WhatsApp, you know, had a large user base. It's grown considerably, of course. But that's a lot of data hanging out there for a company to grab. And, you know, we may not like it, but the people at Facebook that, you know, are hired to obtain and manipulate this data, let's just put it that way, they're smart. They're really, really smart. And, you know, things like this is why Facebook wanted WhatsApp in the first place.
Because Facebook eventually knew that they would put ads inside WhatsApp.
Yeah.
And make it into an e-commerce platform the way that they've done it with Instagram.
Yep. And, you know, look at the changes. WhatsApp used to be a secure messaging platform. Now there's all sorts of interactions you do through WhatsApp. And Facebook would love to have a log of all of those.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because at its core, WhatsApp is still a pretty simple experience compared to something like Instagram, right? There have been changes to WhatsApp, but they're pretty optional, and you can still use it as a straight-up messaging app. And I think that's been it's the reason that it's had so much sustained success as a, quote, private messenger. Yeah. Even though Signal and Telegram have also grown considerably in the last few years.
Yeah.
So here's the question. Would you leave WhatsApp now? Are you going to just abandon it if you're an avid WhatsApp user and get your family? I mean, Joe, you mentioned it's pretty hard to do that. But like, if you're the techie in your family and friend group, do you teach them to use a different service? Or do you just suck it up and continue using WhatsApp?
There's probably like for people like us, there's some sort of obligation to at least try to bring that subject up. And, you know, some people are more sensitive to a change like this than other people are. But at least explain, like, if you have people using this, like, this is what's going on. Like, this is how your data is going to be used. And you can throw the bone there and, like, I guess see if there's any interest from people in your social groups if they want to move. Chances are they're not going to, and you're going to have to suck it up. But I think there's at least no harm in making that attempt to see if you can get people to jump ship. I personally tend to be someone that's a little bit more lenient with this stuff. But if it's a service like this where there's a lot of people, you know, using it, and a lot of those people probably have varying feelings on digital privacy and whatnot, like at least throw it out there and see if you can get a conversation going about what you should all do next.
I mean, the problem I've found is the people that I know that I would talk to over WhatsApp if I used it, I could show them what it's doing and, you know, why they might not like that. And maybe they would agree, oh, this is bad. You know, I'm happy to install Telegram or Signal or whatever and talk to you. But they have friends that use WhatsApp and they're not going to convince their friends to stop using it. So they're still going to use it, which means I'm still going to use it.
I also kind of feel like there's more chance of people switching now, especially after all of the crap that we've dealt with Facebook over the last 2 years. It's, oh, hey, if you want to keep using WhatsApp, Facebook, this devil of a company that we have been preaching against for like however many years and has been dragged before the Senate how many times this year. Yeah, they want to be able to see all of your contacts and how many apps you have on your phone and when the last time you opened each and every one of them is.
Yeah, that idea goes out the window when you look at the new Oculus.
Yeah.
People are buying those things by the bucket loads and not even thinking about Facebook being behind it all.
Wait, and they know they can get away with that. Like, they know they're going to piss some people off with the WhatsApp policy, and I'm sure here and there people are going to drop off and switch to Telegram or something, but I have to imagine the vast majority of people that are using WhatsApp are going to see this, either think, oh, that's annoying, and then just continue, or I just find themselves in that spot where they either don't care or they just can't leave because of so many contacts using it. And it's like, it's the same with Oculus. That's a product that so many people are into, and whether it was with the Quest 1 and people got sucked into it, or people wanted to join the Quest 2 and there's not really a competitor to that, like, Facebook can get away with that stuff, and they know it makes some people angry, but at the end of the day, it's not really hurting them.
I would say if you look at the data today and then look at the data 3 months from today, more people will have joined WhatsApp than left.
I mean, that's probably true, just not because of a privacy policy or any change to the service, but just because Facebook is able to extend its tendrils into its other services in ways that it couldn't before. And there may be ways of onboarding Instagram users to WhatsApp. Yeah. And, you know, with this data sharing, right? You may see ads for WhatsApp. You may see things that will put WhatsApp in a positive light. And for some people, Instagram's changes have actually been a benefit because, you know, you can get targeted ads for, you know, a knife that will cut through plastic or something. And you'll be like, oh man, I need that. And the more they know about you, the more targeted the ads are and the more likely you are to buy something. And the argument has always been with a company like Google and Facebook that ads are a necessary evil and people would rather see ads that they care about than ones that they don't. And the more we know about you, the better we can target those ads towards you. And with WhatsApp, the inevitability of ads is there. It's a certainty. It's coming. Yep. We've already seen tests in India and we're already seeing tests of turning it into an e-commerce platform. So wouldn't you rather this free service continue to be free and show you relevant ads that you care about because there's a bi-directional sharing agreement with Facebook, which already knows so much about you? Again, hugely devil's advocate argument here, and I don't agree with that. I would prefer never to see ads in WhatsApp. But if you're going to do it, you might as well do it.
And, you know, I have to agree with you, except for the fact that Facebook plays very fast and loose with your data. They just the way Microsoft used to. At this point, I don't trust my personal data with anybody but Apple, Google, or Microsoft, because I know exactly what they're going to do with it. You know, companies like Facebook use unspecified third parties. You know that doesn't fly. You can't just tell me you're going to share my data with unspecified third parties and get me to use your service. I realize I'm in the minority, but that's not how you do it. If they safeguard your data and use your data to enhance your experience, because as you said, if you're going to see ads, wouldn't you rather see ads for products that you might actually want to buy? So I'm okay with that, but it's how you guard my privacy is what's important.
All right, so we've spoken about WhatsApp and Facebook and Trump for 27 minutes. That's a long time. Let's talk about some tech. It's CES, at least by the time you hear this, it'll probably be CES or closer to. As with every year, the companies launch a barrage of products in the days before CES officially starts. And then next Tuesday is the official start date, January 12th. It runs through the 14th or 15th. But most of the big announcements happened the week before. Samsung announced a bunch of TVs and washing machines and eco-friendly packaging and something else expensive. Yesterday, today has been a whole bunch of Chromebook and other, you know, laptop announcements from Lenovo and tablets and whatnot. So let's walk through them. We'll start with the some Samsung stuff. So no surprise at all, Samsung announced a bunch of really high-end 8K TVs. Some of them have micro-LED technology. Others are just improvements to the old QLED tech. One thing that stuck out to me, though, is that Google Duo and native Android screen sharing is now a thing within these TVs, which means that you'll be able to attach a webcam and get native Google Duo support on these televisions, which is something that as a parent who follows his kid around the living room when she wants to speak to her grandmother, I find this to be a very affordable alternative to something like a portal, speaking of Facebook. And I just think, this feels like a very native addition to a batch of 2021 televisions where people are spending a lot more time in the living room than they ever did.
Yeah, for the most part it is. I mean, I'm not quite as excited about I'm going to be able to hook up the webcam and use my TV as a video thing. I'll be more excited about that when I can use it for Google Meet and just put all my meetings on the TV instead of putting them on my laptop. But it's going to be useful for a lot of families. It's going to be useful for a lot of normal people, except for the fact that I'm still not sure how many people are using Google Duo as opposed to using Facebook Messenger, FaceTime, all those things. Duo still has room to make up there, but this could help.
it's fascinating to me that Samsung and Google tend to be friends when it's convenient to both of them. This is an instance where it totally makes sense for Google to push one of its burgeoning and increasingly popular video messaging platforms on a partner's television. And, you know, obviously you can screen share on a Chromecast with Google TV. There are apps that support that. But the fact that you can get this native functionality is really interesting. The other thing that's cool, though, is that with these new televisions, their faster processor allows you to have up to four windows at a time. So you can actually have a dual call in a window while you're watching cable or playing a video game or something like that. So it's sort of a, you're turning it into a bit of a local streaming platform, which is really interesting. And that's only going to continue, right? As TVs become computers, more like computers. And I mean, that's all there is to it, right? Google Duo is the initial integration, but I wouldn't be surprised, you're right, Ara, if Google Meet gets added later this year, Zoom and Microsoft Teams. I mean, Dell, you know, bless its heart, released a batch of televisions that have a built-in pop-up selfie cam and a dedicated Microsoft Teams button. So, yeah.
The only thing that kind of sticks out to me with the televisions, like, I get the multitasking thing with running four apps at one time, like, that has to be reserved for these newer models just because the faster processors and everything. But I would like to see Samsung, if they see them expand that optional webcam to maybe some of their older TVs, just because, you know, yeah, being able to have your TV and use that for Zoom calls in 2021 sounds really cool, but I don't know how many people are going to be going out and buying a brand new TV when we are still in the middle of a pandemic and a lot of people are still facing very tight budgets and stuff. So,
well, also, I want to know how many people, like, I don't want a smart TV. I want a high quality, dumb TV that I can stick whatever smart thing I want into it. Am I in the minority there?
What do you mean stick into it?
Like, my parents have a Vizio TV. Half the apps don't work. The other half are so old and outdated that they are just absolutely crap. I bought my mom a Google TV for Christmas this year because I wanted there to be a better experience for streaming TV in the kitchen. For both of my both of the TVs that I have, I took my parents' hand-me-downs because I was like, oh, I just need a dumb TV because, oh, y'all want a new TV? I'll take your TV that still works and I'll just plug my Shield TV into it. And that's all I needed.
I mean, I feel you. I've got an Alexa TV with an NVIDIA Shield TV plugged into it for the same reason. It's just, it's not up to date. And it doesn't do what I like. But I think in this case, Era, that's what you've got. You've got a dumb TV minus Samsung's smart TV crap, which you can completely ignore. Google Duo is probably running on a separate little chip that runs Android things.
Wait, I thought Android things was dead.
Well, whatever they've renamed it, that runs inside the Nest Hub.
Okay.
Because that's all you would need to run Google Duo. You know, it's a way to store your account credentials and a way to run the app. And of course, we don't know all the technical details about these televisions yet. Just, you know, a spec sheet. Hopefully somebody somewhere will get one to review it and they can really dig into it. And I'll know if I'm right or wrong, but that is my guess. Best guess at this point is there's whatever Samsung smart TV stuff is baked into it. And then just a separate little board, like the one you would use for, you know, HDR10 or Dolby Vision, a tiny little board that runs the software needed to run Google apps. Which would be a beautifully smart idea.
I mean, I don't think it's surprising that TV manufacturers are trying to capture some of the video conferencing intent.
Right.
And there have already been solutions for hooking up a webcam to your television. Just back in December, Amazon announced that it was adding webcam support to the Fire TV Cube. It only works right now with a word services, so it doesn't work with Zoom or anything other than an Amazon powered solution. So you can call other Echo shows or, you know, a phone that has the Alexa app, sorry, but it, you know, it, that's not a great solution, right? Whereas it would be nice if you could just plug and play, as you said, right? Buy a cheap webcam. Most TVs have a USB-A port. You just plug it in and it works the way that it does on a computer. And there's no reason that can't be the case with a Samsung TV, given that it's powerful enough and it's running Tizen, which is, we know, a very scalable, relatively powerful operating system that can run Android apps. So there's no reason the native Google Duo app couldn't run on a Tizen PC or Tizen television.
Another alternative, it could be running on the same processor that Samsung is running their smart stuff on, and it somehow can separate itself from Bixby.
Right.
So we don't know exactly how it works yet, but I don't think it's going to depend on Samsung continuously updating their Bixby service and their smart TV apps to stay up to date. I think this is always just going to work if you plug a webcam in, which I still, you know, maybe a better solution is the Chromecast with Google TV that has a USB port in the side to plug a webcam in. Wouldn't that be like the best solution?
The Google TV supports USB-C hub, so you could plug in a webcam right now. There's just no apps to take advantage of it. And also, it's a little bit too underpowered to run video calls, I think.
So, you know, I'm not sure where Google's strategy is. Maybe they want to work with manufacturers instead.
I mean, as we're recording this, Sony just came out with its announced its 2021 video television lineup, and all of them have HDMI 2.1. They are, you know, they all run Android TV. They're among the first to support Google TV, which is the overlay that launched with the Chromecast with Google TV.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, this is a big change. A lot of them are OLED. So this will be great for like PlayStation and Xbox users, but it should be considerably easier to hook up a webcam and just have it work for this year's lineup of OLED or LG, Vizio, Samsung, and you know, TCL televisions.
Yeah, I mean, all the video decoding stuff is already on the TV.
Right.
So all you need is something that can run the Android app framework.
Yeah, I mean, all we're waiting for now is native Stadia support for Google TV, and then it'll be perfect.
Yep.
We'll see when that happens. All right, let's talk about some Chromebooks. Ara,
yay!
Two Chromebooks announced so far at CES. I think that's all of them until next week, where we'll get a bunch of education-focused ones. But the two that have been announced were pretty interesting. So walk us through the Samsung Galaxy Chromebook 2 and the Acer Chromebook Spin 514.
So the Galaxy Chromebook 2 is... Samsung did the same thing with the Galaxy Chromebook that they did with the Galaxy S20. Oh, this was about $300, $400 too expensive for most people to stomach in 2020. So we're going to bring down the specs to something a little bit more manageable. We're going to bring down the costs to something a little bit more manageable while still giving you that Samsung design, that bold Samsung look. And hopefully it's going to resonate more with shoppers. So the Galaxy Chromebook 2 is 1080p instead of 4K. And instead of it being a Project Athena with an i5 and a fingerprint sensor and a built-in stylus, it's either an i3 or a Celeron processor. By the way, the $550 Celeron version, I don't think anybody's going to really want to spend money on, because $550 for a Celeron computer is just kind of nuts, even if it is Samsung. But they swapped out they got rid of the fingerprint sensor. That saved you probably $100. They got rid of the built-in pin and made that something that you buy separately. That probably lopped off another $50 to $75. But they still have that that active pin support. So it's going to be it's a Chromebook that's more functional while still being very, very pretty and still being very, very thin. Although it's not quite as thin or quite as light as the original Galaxy Chromebook was. So I'm looking forward to it. I really want to get one in my hands, and I want to see whether or not it has the battery life that it needs to, because they fixed some of the battery woes with the Galaxy Chromebook in later updates, but the launch battery life on the Galaxy Chromebook was abysmal, and I really want to see whether or not the new Galaxy Chromebook 2 will heat up as ridiculously as the Galaxy Chromebook one did.
I'm sorry, don't buy this Chromebook. Just
that's
don't.
Okay, Jerry. Just, you can be more positive about the next one.
Yeah, don't buy this Chromebook unless you really, really like the orange color. I really like the orange color, and I have to admit, I might buy it if I had that kind of money to throw away. But for $140 more, you can get a Pixelbook Go with an i5, equal amounts of RAM, faster non-EMCC storage, arguably lesser screen, but a much better trackpad, keyboard, and, you know, faster support. Unless orange is your thing, don't buy this. They're both way too expensive. I like that Samsung realized they needed to jack the price down. I hate to see them get rid of the $1,100 super high-end Chromebook because...
Oh, I think that's going to stick around.
I hope so, because I know a lot of people that are very happy with that purchase.
But Jerry, the thing here is also that it was a matter of the Galaxy Chromebook 2 is kind of like the Pixelbook Go.
Yeah, just more expensive, and I don't know.
The $550 one is too expensive, just flat out. That one's probably not going to be worth your time.
Buy a Lenovo Chromebook for $350 with the same specs. It'll run just as well. It's just not orange.
Well, I mean, you can buy a Lenovo. The Flex 5 is $400, comes with an i3, 4 gigabytes of RAM, and 64 gigabytes of storage. So you'll get a better processor and the same other specs across the board for $150 less. So it's one of those things that you're paying for the Samsung name and you're paying for the Samsung look, which not a lot of people are going to be able to really justify considering all Chromebooks run the same software. And if you're going to look at hardware, the specs that matter are your processor and your RAM. And I'm not sure $550 for a Chromebook with only 4 gigabytes of RAM is going to fly in 2021.
It would have been nice to see if they, I guess, like after what we saw with the S20 FE, where they could take like a flagship phone and make the right compromises to make that a more affordable device that's still high end. Like I know that those are two very different things, but I guess from my perspective, it would have been nice to see them be able to pull something similar off. But again, I get that making an affordable, the whole Android and Chromebook, like making two devices that are kind of like a fan edition or whatever you want to call it. Like I get that that's a different ball game for those two.
I'll be dead honest. What I expected from the Galaxy Chromebook 2 fanboy edition, whatever it was going to be called, was an M3, 8 gigs of RAM, 128 gigs of storage for $599. And if they had done that, I would say buy it right now. Because that's going to be one of the best mid-range Chromebooks you can buy. But right now they've got a low-end Chromebook with a mid-range price and a mid-range Chromebook with a high-end price. And that just doesn't cut it unless you really like the Samsung name or that orange color.
Yeah, if you want a little bit more value for your Chromebook in 2021, the CES Chromebook to look at was the Acer Chromebook Spin 514.
I agree on that one.
Because the Acer Chromebook that was announced today, and I have it sitting right here behind me because I need to get back to writing my my hands on whenever we're done here. But this is a $480 Chromebook, or it starts at $480. For that money, you get a Ryzen processor. It's the lower configurations have the Ryzen 3000 chip, and then the higher configurations have a Ryzen 5 or a Ryzen 7 series chip. But you get 4 to 8 gigabytes of RAM, 64 to 128 gigabytes of eMMC storage. But the real trick for storage here is that you can add on an M2 SSD if you want. So it's like, the configuration I got only came with 64 and I'm tired of just using a micro SD card. No problem. Just unscrew the bottom plate and you can slot in a 256 gig SSD if you want. And that's going to be amazing, especially considering that Chromebooks are, I think, the only laptops that can download videos from like Netflix and Disney Plus and watch them offline. So this is going to be my disaster, everything went offline, and I still want to watch stuff computer.
Yeah, this that the Asus, the, you know, the Spin 514 is one I really, really want to get my hands on just to see what it takes to break it. The Ryzen chip that's in it, it can run a little bit hot, but after talking to Acer yesterday and you know, seeing some photos of it, they've got the heat figured out. So it's going to run much better than an equivalent, you know, Celeron or M3 chip is. It has much better graphics support. And man, that M2 SSD slot, 5 screws, and you've got a terabyte of storage in there if you want.
Yeah, no, that's going to be useful.
I want to interrupt for a sec, because it does seem like, even though on paper this Spin 514 is a better product, it's more flexible, it's also, you know, a pound and a half heavier.
Oh, than
the Chromebook.
It's also a 14-inch touchscreen instead of a 13-inch.
I complained about that yesterday, Daniel.
it's going for a very different consumer here, right? And the Galaxy Chromebook 2 is very aesthetically, for like, aesthetics first. The keyboard is going to be awesome. The screen is going to be great. We know that because it's Samsung. The fact that it supports a USI stylus, which, you know, it doesn't come in the box, but that's one of the first Chromebooks to do so.
We've had USI Chromebooks for about a year, year and a half now.
Okay, but it's still not a super common feature. I think that it's compelling. I want to know, Samsung had the choice, right? It's very difficult in the laptop world right now, especially if you're forced to include an Intel chip, right? Celeron is always considered underpowered, but Chromebooks don't need a ton of power. Would it have been better to, as Jerry suggested, step down to something like the entry-level Pixelbook Go configuration of a slower M3 with 8 gigs of RAM versus an i3 with 4 gigs of RAM and charge the same same amount?
Then I'd be happier recommending it, because they could shave $150 off the price.
Right. But you're getting a much more powerful chip with the i3.
Yes, but that also extended another $100, and you can get an i5 and a Pixelbook Go, which we both know is very high quality, thin, light, superb Chromebook.
Right, but it's also $850 at that configuration.
I mean, if you want an i5, and you can get an i5 Acer Spin 713 for $630, it was $550 for all of December. And that was a bright 2K screen and a 2-in-1 form factor, and it had all the ports, because the Galaxy Chromebook 2 still only has the 2 USB-C ports and a microSD slot.
Let's talk about the Ryzen chips inside this Acer laptop. Walk me through the differences. What is a Ryzen 3000? Which Ryzen 5 and Ryzen 7 options are available?
Era, you can correct me if I'm wrong here. I think the consumer model has the Ryzen 3 3250.
Yes. There's going to be an enterprise version that I think also has that option, because there's different configurations for the enterprise, but the base one starts with the 3000, with the 3250.
But you're also going to be able to get an unnamed Ryzen 7 series chip in the enterprise model, which is, you know, your Intel Core i7 competitor. The biggest thing about Ryzen ARM chips is they're a better APU. They're a better application processing unit. They have much better graphics than Intel's built-in graphics. The communications between the two are much faster. This is going to outperform an M3 easily. Unless Acer has done something to screw up the thermals, I'm very confident that they haven't.
Is the 3230 supposed to outperform the M3, or just the Ryzen 7, the Ryzen 5 and the Ryzen 7 series?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the Ryzen 3250C is going to outperform an M3.
I mean, when I've been playing with this so far, I'm like, this is a lot like the Acer 434 that I was rocking in 2019 for a while, and I like this a lot. I like the hinge more than I liked the Asus. And now that the Asus 434 is 2 years old, because it was announced at CES 2019, and the Acer 436 is just too expensive for most people to even consider it, because it starts at 800 and goes up from there. This is going to be the Chromebook that it's like, okay, it starts at 480. You'll probably, and it'll probably get decent sales around back to school to get it down to like 425, 400. This is going to be a this is going to be one of the Chromebooks to beat for the year.
Yeah, you have to think before you spend $479 on a Chromebook. Do you need a Chromebook or want a Chromebook bad enough to spend that much money on one? You know, I know Era, myself, you know, maybe Joe, maybe Daniel would say yes. We're more entrenched in that ecosystem. A lot of people are not going to want to spend $479 on a Chromebook. So, you know, you'll look to companies like Lenovo or other Asus or Acer products and find something a little bit cheaper.
One of our colleagues was slacking me this morning asking about the Lenovo Lenovo Flex 5 or whatever weird variant name it gets in the UK, because he was like, okay, this is the one that you reviewed last year, right? Because I'm going to spend £400 on it for my kid, because that's what his kid needs for school.
But if you do, or you know, are willing to spend $400 to $500 on a Chromebook, I really think this is where you need to look first. So far, like, you know, there's more Chromebooks coming, but right now I think where the premium starts, the bottom of the premium models of Chromebooks, this is the best one I've seen yet.
Yeah,
it is interesting that it looks like the Ryzen 3 3250C, the one in the base model Acer, is a bit more powerful than the Core i3 inside the step up Galaxy Chromebook 2. Core, you know, four threads. It's got a higher base clock. Looks like, as Jerry said, there's a faster GPU. It's just a newer chip. They're both 14 nanometer. It's not necessarily a low wattage chip. It's 15 watts, but it's still fairly efficient. And it does seem like it's a really good option if you want to save a couple $100. So I wouldn't even worry too much about the Ryzen 5 or Ryzen 7 options. This just seems like a really good solution if you are looking for a decent Chromebook without spending a ton of money.
Right. Yeah, the only thing here is I'm really hoping that there's only one or two configurations with 4 gigabytes of RAM, because the one that they sent me has 8, and 8 gigabytes of RAM is probably what you should be looking for when you're buying a new Chromebook for full-time work or for learning from home in 2021.
And the one you have is the 3000?
Yeah, the configuration that they sent me is the 3250C processor, 8 gigabytes of RAM, and 128 gigabytes of storage.
Nice. See, that's an awesome Chromebook.
Yes. Yes. This is exactly the model that I want to recommend to people whenever it's available for purchase in February. Well,
they are
it's a 14-inch Chromebook.
But I'm going to tell you that I asked them yesterday. They have followed the same design language and the same hinge configuration for their high-end Spin series the last 3 years. Because I had the first one for a while, the 714, I think it was, 715.
Mm-hmm.
That is a tank. You could run over it with your car. So it weighs a pound more than you might like it to weigh, but it's not like that pound of weight is wasted. That sucker is a beast.
They made a point of saying that they've tested this to the mil standard durability, and they've tried to bring as much knowledge as they can about how to build a durable laptop from what they've learned from however many years of building education Chromebooks. So it's one of those things of it's going to be a little bit more heavy. It's going to be a little bit more sturdy. And that means that it's going to last longer, because I'm hoping that the auto expiration update for this is either going to be June 2029 or June 2030.
I sound like a fanboy. Maybe I am. I love the 5-position hinge. If you go to open this Chromebook, it's really light and easy to open until it gets to like 85 degrees. And then the hinge kind of locks in place. So you can grab it by the the bottom and move it around, and you're, it's not going to flop around. But then you give it a little bit of pressure, and when it gets to flat, the hinge locks in place again. When it gets to tent mode, it locks in place again. And when you fold it completely over on itself to act as a tablet, it locks in place. But in any other position, it's just, you know, take one finger and just give it a tap and it'll move. I love how they did that.
That does sound pretty sweet.
The way that it folds flat is a little weird to me, but I'm happy that it'll get to flat and stop.
All right, that's enough Chromebook stuff. We're moving on.
No, there's never enough Chromebook stuff.
There's never enough Chromebook stuff.
Look, if I didn't put a stop to this, the entire podcast would be
about... Oh, don't worry. I'll be back with more Chromebook funness. BET is in 2 weeks, and it's going to be lit.
Your definition of lit is very suspicious. All right, let's move on. Joe, there are 4 new Motorola phones. I don't even know where to begin.
Why?
So I'm just delegating this entire segment to you.
I was going to say, if we're talking about bad definitions of lit, I think this is a good segue.
Yeah, let's dive into the Moto G, 3 Moto Gs and a Motorola One. What does Motorola have for us in early 2021?
Okay. We'll start with the Motorola One 5G Ace, which is like the... These are all budget phones, but this is just kind of like the more technically impressive one, I guess, if you want to call it that. Motorola's marketing it as their cheapest 5G phone they've put out yet, which is true. It's going to be available unlocked for $399, and there will be some carrier partners for that as well. All of the processors for these phones are really interesting. The One 5G Ace is powered by a Snapdragon 750G, which is essentially kind of like a pared-down version of the 765G that's in the Pixel 5 and the 4a 5G and some of those devices we saw last year. The RAM is a bit disappointing. It's 4 gigs of RAM, 64 gigs of storage that is expandable, 6.7-inch Full HD Plus display, 5,000 milliamp-hour battery, which Motorola is touting up to 3 days of use, which is basically the case for almost all of these phones. As far as the camera system goes, the camera system on the One 5G Ace, the G Stylus, and the G Power is exactly this, basically the same. 48 megapixel primary sensor, 8 megapixel ultra wide, 2 megapixel macro. So, kind of typical affair for a mid tier phone that we'd see in 2020 or 2021. It does have NFC, which is, I shouldn't have to say that's surprising, but it is for kind of a lower cost Motorola phone. So you will be able to use Google Pay. There's a headphone jack if you want to use that. And like I said, it's $399. So it is pretty affordable, I guess, as far as 5G phones go, though I still don't think that's really a selling point, just given where 5G is in the US at this point. It's good for future-proofing, obviously, but you can make the argument that you could spend $50 less for a Pixel 4a or get something like a OnePlus N10 5G. So...
Let me ask you a question on that, Joe. That's 5G, but that's only T-Mobile's and Sprint sub-6 5G, right?
Yeah, it's only sub-6. There's no millimeter wave on this thing.
Okay.
So, yeah, I guess that's another point. It is technically a cheap 5G phone. And
it's a 4.5G phone.
Yeah, millimeter wave is certainly far from perfect. Like, you can talk endlessly about the range and the coverage issues, but you're not going to get those like blistering fast speeds that the carriers market and everything. So that's that one.
Hang on. I before we move on, I do want to talk a little bit about the 750G, because I believe other than the Xiaomi Mi 10i that was announced a couple of days ago, this is the first phone that North America will see with this new Snapdragon 750G, which is a cheaper version of the 765G that we praised, you know, a lot last year. And it was a very impressive device, impressive chip. But it kind of sat in the middle. It took a lot of the same hardware features from the 865, right? The same, not the same, but very capable DSP and ISP for AI and camera functionality, but it paired back the power, right? It was a much less capable GPU, and the CPUs were basically like in between the Snapdragon 835 and 845. So really not super impressive. The 750 is slightly less powerful than that as well. So it's got two Cortex A77 cores, and then it has six Cortex A55 cores, and it's got an Adreno 619 GPU. So you're going to see like mid-2018 flagship performance out of this. It's a step up from the 600 series, the 690 5G, which is in the OnePlus Nord N10 5G, but not quite as good as something like the LG Velvet or the OnePlus Nord or the myriad other Snapdragon 765G powered phones from last year, including the Pixel 4a 5G, which is only $100 more. So just putting that into perspective here, this is a $400 phone, but it does fit right in the middle of like the OnePlus Nord N10 and the Pixel 4a 5G.
And I'll say that too, I can't go into a full review of this yet, but just given the time I've been using it, like it feels like a pretty fast and responsive phone. I haven't tried any, you know, intensive gaming yet, but just for like my daily apps and basic multitasking, like it, I've had no speed complaints. Now, like the 4 gigs of RAM is obviously a concern because that's not a lot of RAM for a Android phone in 2021 or 2020. But the processor, I don't really have any concern around that. Like it sounds, I guess, maybe scary to say, oh, this is a lesser 765, but it's been perfectly fine so far.
Daniel, in case you know this, because apparently you're up to snuff, there is no millimeter wave option for the 750G at all, is there?
There is, yeah. There's a configuration of it that supports it. It's just not with this, because...
So this could potentially be a Verizon phone.
It could, yeah. It might actually be a Verizon phone once they make that announcement. They did the same thing with the Motorola Edge.
That's why I was asking, yeah.
You know, it was a Motorola, there was a Verizon variant, and then there was an unlocked variant that was sub-6 only.
And one last thing, that name is so cool. The Motorola One 5G Ace.
Is it?
I kind of like, it gives me that Top Gun vibe.
Okay, sure. We'll go with that.
Yeah. Outside of that, though, moving on from the Top Gun Motorola phone. Next one is the Moto, I guess next one going from like price highest to lowest, is the Moto G Stylus, which is just the 2021 version of the Moto G Stylus they introduced last year because Motorola is trying to move away from numerical naming schemes. So it's just the 2021 Stylus. This one is almost identical to the previous Stylus. It has the same 4 gigs of RAM, 128 gigs of storage, 4,000 milliamp-hour battery. It looks like a slightly upgraded camera system, though probably going to be very similar to what we had last year. The only big change for this is that it is a Snapdragon 678 instead of the 665. So that is it should be a decent upgrade. I think this is the chipset we were talking about that was announced in December or November, fairly late in 2020.
Yeah, it was December.
Yeah, so I think this is, as far as my knowledge goes, the first 678 phone we're going to see in the US. So there'll be a nice performance jump there. As far as the actual stylus goes, Motorola added kind of like a click function on the top of it, and they've rounded it out a bit more to be more comfortable. But there's still no like active integration with the display, so it's just a passive stylus. Like if you bought any stylus from Amazon, it just has that same function. So it's not like mimicking the Galaxy Note experience.
Motorola, you're stupid.
What? Yeah.
That's just so dumb. Go on, I'm sorry.
No, you're good. I mean, I haven't had a lot of experience with the stylus myself, but I know Daniel used the 2020 model, and I know you weren't very impressed with that whole writing experience with the kind of hardware they're using.
No, it's a passive stylus. It's garbage. Like there's really no other way to put it. It's basically It's the same experience as you buying a $10 stylus from Amazon and using it on any phone, except that this one is built into the side of the bottom of the phone. It's a nice clicky little silo like the Galaxy Note, but because there's no digitizer, there's no dedicated Wacom layer the way that there is on a Note, there's no pressure sensitivity. There's insane input lag, like to the point where after writing a couple of words, you're just going to get fed up and stop doing it. And we talked to Motorola about this. We asked them why they didn't upgrade the stylus other than just to make it a little bit more comfortable. It's now round instead of flat. And it came down to price. Obviously, it's expensive to install that Wacom layer and to make it an active stylus versus a passive one. And they said that they have a lot of data to show that most people didn't use the first gen stylus for writing, taking notes so much as they did for annotating documents or sketching, which doesn't need the same amount of input as if you were to take notes. So that, yeah. I suppose I get. I mean, it's marketing speak.
If they had put a good stylus in the first one, maybe more people would have used the damn thing.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said,
what's the click function do?
Nothing. It's the way you get it out of the silo.
Oh, okay. I thought that Joe meant there was a click, like a Bic pen on top or something.
Clicky
button. You can mimic a Bic pen, but other than that, it doesn't do anything.
Well, if you had a hammer, you could make a Bic pen fit in the hole.
Yeah, so I mean, that's $299. It's the same price as a 2020 model, so it's not exciting, but I mean, you're getting a better processor and everything else is the same, so
good price.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot to complain about for that one.
I mean, you're missing the most interesting part, is that there's now a side-mounted fingerprint sensor.
I don't consider that very fascinating or interesting, but yeah, that is a thing on this one, and
it's not a fascinating thing, but it's literally the most fascinating thing. It's cool because you get to double tap it and bring up what they're calling MyUX, which was introduced on the Motorola Edge series, to quickly go into different shortcuts. So you can like double tap and then quickly take a photo or open up your, you know, a shortcut to Google Maps or whatever you want to configure it with. I don't know. It's kind of neat.
It's weird. They introduced that on the, believe it or not, a different phone, just the regular Motorola One 5G that came out last year for AT&T. But that's not present at all on the One 5G Ace. That just has a regular rear-mounted fingerprint sensor, which, I mean, I prefer, but it is weird. It's absent from there, but present on the stylus and the power. But
you gotta love consistency.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you look at the pictures for the rear camera housings and just like where the hole punches are, these designs are all over the damn place. It's fascinating. Speaking of fascinating, there is the 2021 Moto G Power, which is its own beast. So the 2020 G Power was kind of my favorite Moto G that came out last year. It had that $250 price. It was just kind of a good phone all around, and it was fairly easy to recommend, but the 2021 model is like basically a downgrade in the two most important ways. It's got a Snapdragon 662 processor, which compared to last year's model had a 665. So I don't know if a lot of people will notice like a major performance difference, but if you want to get technical, like you are still getting a slightly worse chipset with a lower CPU clock speed than last year's G Power. What's kind of mind-boggling, though, is that the display is 6.6 inches and has a 1600 by 720 HD plus resolution.
What?
Yeah, so the 2020 G Power had a 6.4 inch display with a full HD plus, so you're getting like over 130 less pixels per inch on the new model, which is...
Does it look like a screen door, Joe?
Yeah, I've only gotten to the lock screens or to the boot up screen so far, and it is not pleasant to look at. But it's a 5,000 milliamp hour battery, 48 megapixel primary camera, headphone jack, expandable storage, no NFC, obviously. There is a cheaper model this time with 3 gigs of RAM and 32 gigs of storage for $199 and 4 gigs of RAM and 64 gigs of storage for $249, which that $249 price for 4 gigs and 64 gigs of storage was the exact same price and kind of set up for the 2020 power. So you're, unless you want that upgraded camera experience, which in early testing seems like it's not that drastic of a change from the 2020 model, you're basically just getting the same phone with a worse display and a slightly worse processor for the same $250. I don't know what the point of this phone is or how it got to this stage, but it is one of the most mind-boggling releases I think I've probably seen from this company in a while.
Once this thing gets on Amazon for $249 unlocked, a lot of people are going to buy it and really like it, because it's only $250. And I think that's what Lenovo and Motorola are banking on here. We can nitpick it, but it's only $250 and it runs all your apps and you can talk to all your friends.
True. It's what's irritating though is like, I know from their perspective, they're saving money probably on that, the display resolution difference. And they're going to maybe have better margins on this compared to the 2020 model. But like last year, we got an objectively better phone for the same price, and its quote unquote successor is like technically a worse phone, and it's the same price. So just from that perspective, it's kind of hard to wrap my head around. I'm sure from business perspective, maybe a slightly bigger margin, it makes them happy, but it's just kind of a crummy sequel to what was a pretty darn good phone last year.
I mean, if we want to talk about inferior phones, my little sister spent money on an LG K30 this week for her boss, because her boss is just so reticent to change and he just wanted something as close as possible to his last phone. And it's a phone that came with Android 9 and is never getting another update.
What so, was his any last phone? An LG Chocolate?
An LG K20.
Oh, poor guy.
Yeah, no. So there are worse phones out there, but yeah, that's still a downgrade in most ways for no real apparent reason other than just cutting corners.
Yeah, like I said, that's my main issue with it. Not to say like the phone overall is terrible. It's just you're comparing this directly to the predecessor. There's not a lot of redeeming factors to it.
Do you still have last year's model there, Joe?
No, I don't. I had to send that to Hayato for video stuff at some point last year.
Because, you know, other than the display, which you're going to notice, I'll bet you don't notice any difference in performance between the, what is it, 665 and 662.
No, they're basically identical. I did this research yesterday. There's a 1% performance difference between the two. The 662 is a 665 clocked down 100 megahertz. Everything else about it is identical. The GPU is the same. The CPU is otherwise like the core designs are identical. The ISP and DSP are the same. So you're basically getting just a very minor, you know, slower clocked version. It should be a little bit more efficient as a result.
Yep.
I'm just at a loss to explain the justifications for some of these clawbacks, given the fact that Motorola is asking the same price for the mainline version. There is a $200 version that'll be exclusive to Best Buy, which has 3 gigs of RAM and 32 gigs of storage. But then, like, I still don't understand why that exists when the Moto G Play, which, Joe, take it away, also exists. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, so the G Play, it's $169. It's a Snapdragon 460, 3 gigs of RAM, 6.5-inch 720 HD plus display, another 5,000 mAh battery. The camera is probably going to be quite a bit downgraded. It's a 13-megapixel primary, just a 2-megapixel depth sensor. So that and the processor, like the two big downgrades there. Again, this is a $169 phone, which is pretty nice price, and it's a very affordable option for people that really don't have a lot of money to spend. But then again, you can make the justification of if there is a $200 Moto G Power this time around with a better processor, more RAM, better camera, why would you not spend the extra $30? Now, granted, some people do have very tight spending habits, and like maybe you only can afford a $169 phone, but if you can't afford another $30, like I don't see a redeeming factor to this when that 200 model for the power is a thing this time around.
If this was any company besides Motorola, this would be the phone that you would find inside clamshell packaging on a shelf at Walmart with a prepaid SIM card in it. That would make sense, but I don't think I've seen Motorola do that for ages. So I'm going to have to agree. I mean, what's this for?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the problem they fell into last year, too. They had the Moto E, the Moto G Fast, the Moto G Power, and the Moto G Stylus, which were all within $50 of their prices. So you could look at the Moto E and be like, oh, that's $150. That's a really good deal. But you get a substantially better phone with the Moto G Fast for $50 more. You could go another $50 for the G Power and so on. It's like it's even tighter margins this time around because it's 170 versus 200. And like I said, $30 more for a vastly better phone. Like it just kind of makes sense. So Motorola just, they kind of throw everything at the wall with a lot of very similar price tags and just let people choose what they want. But it does mean they kind of self-compete with themselves, and some of these devices just make their other releases just, I don't know, not justified or something.
It's the ThinkPad all over again when Lenovo bought the rights from IBM. Just make 700 different configurations and see what sells.
Mm-hmm. And that's been Motorola's pattern for, I guess, a couple years now, so it's not surprising. It's just they keep doing it over and over again.
I mean, it's more than possible Lenovo has the capability to manufacture these things almost on demand. So if that's the case, offer as many models as you want, and the ones that sell fast, it's easy to crank out another 25,000 units.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was looking today at the... there was a Moto G9 Play that launched in markets outside of the U.S. back in August of 2020. And like spec for spec, that is the exact same phone as the G Power we're getting this year. So like these are probably not very expensive phones for them to make and produce. I'm sure they're reusing parts and designs, and these are incredibly cheap for them to kick out, and they're going to make a shitload of money reselling them to U.S. customers. Hmm.
It's hard to justify when phones like the Pixel 4a exist.
Yeah, well, we haven't gotten to the cherry on top for these phones, though.
Oh, my God.
Wait, there's more? Really?
There's more. So when Motorola launches their Moto G phones, they always tend to come out first half or first quarter of 20 of the new year. So last year's phones shipped with Android 10 because Android 10 had come out in September, August of 2019. All four of these phones are shipping with Android 10 still. So it's already outdated software, and as per Motorola's infinite wisdom of their update policy, they are still only getting one quote-unquote software update, which is to Android 11, which I would happily argue is just getting off of outdated software to current software. They've said they will consider additional updates, but if you know anything about these budget Moto G phones or the really cheap Motorola One phones, these things are never going to see Android 12. They're on Android 10. Android 11 is coming at some point. There's still not even an ETA for that, but that is the only update that these things will see.
I blame Google for that, plain and freaking simple. Google allows them to license Android and do that with it. So Google, this is on you.
I'm with Jerry. There's no good answer for that, except that Google needs to take more affirmative stances on, hey, if you're going to release a phone with our branding on the front and with our software inside, you need to take more of an initiative to keep it updated.
Well, no,
our entire lives are on these phones. They need to be updated and secure.
I'm fine if a company says you're not ever getting a version update. You don't buy a phone hoping it gets updated to a new version of software any more than you would buy a computer today hope that Windows 11 comes out for it. But it's got to be current. It's got to have the features and, you know, privacy protections that have been built into Android right now. You can't release it on old stuff that was, oh, this has some issues, so let's fix it with a new version. But Motorola, it's okay for you to sell them with the software that had the issues. That's just wrong. That's not how you do it.
Yeah, and they did the same thing with the One 5G, but like there was some leniency there because that came out in September where Android 11 was hot off the press. But we're talking phones that are coming out in January 2021. Android 11 has been a thing for months at this point. Like I understand that this past year has been a whirlwind for companies and it's upended a lot of work processes, but I mean, we've seen, I'm sure Samsung's going to come out with the S21. That's going to be running Android 11. I don't see an excuse for them to be launching these on Android 10 and saying, you know, your one update you're going to get is going to get you to current software and then we're out.
And by the time you get it, that software might be old.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, there's still no ETAs or like dates for these. Android 11 is coming at some point, so it could very well be months before that lands on these phones. Like we could be talking about Android 12 and the beta for that by the time Android 11 comes to these devices.
Yeah, I also think this is an opportunity for companies like Samsung and LG to really focus on the $200 to $300 budget market, right? This is a growing part of the unlocked market. It's more competitive than ever. But last year, Samsung really focused on like the $400+ market. They did have the A01, A21, A11, et cetera, but they didn't really make a huge impact in North America. And I think Samsung likes to play just in the higher margin space for obvious reasons, but there is probably a lot of opportunity here. And LG as well, like they just announced the Stylus 7 and they're also really good at making budget devices, but Samsung's update record now is just so much better than LG's and Motorola's that this is Samsung's game. And if Google wanted to make a $200 Android phone, then nobody would be complaining about that either.
Nope.
So I mean, we have to talk about the OnePlus Nord and 10 5G, the OnePlus Nord N100. Both of them are now available in North America, $180 and $300. They're fine, but they're not great phones. I've used the N10 5G. It's not great. So yeah, and that also has a similar software update promise, which is pretty bad.
I'm surprised that Samsung hasn't seen this market, because can you imagine if the Galaxy S21, let's not call it the FE, let's call it the Lite, had a Snapdragon 750G in it and had a good 1080p screen, a good plastic back, an SD card slot, you know, 6 gigs of RAM, and sold for $300.
Yeah, but then Samsung wouldn't be making any money from it.
I bet Samsung could make that phone for $200. They wouldn't be making as much money on it, but you could make it up in volume. Because, you know, we would be the first people to say, this is the budget phone you should buy. And, you know, you get carriers on board to go that route. This is, oh, you're looking for something budget? This is, you know, $50 more expensive than what Motorola and LG offer, but it's a much better phone. We think you'll really like it. And I can't understand why Samsung hasn't seen that. And I know the Galaxy A70, what was 50?
A71 and A51.
51 mm-hmm. and 71. I know those were decent phones, but if they could just crank it up just a notch, they could own that market.
Yeah, and like that's not to say like all of these Motorola phones are bad or unusable. It's just every year it gets harder and harder to justify with the software situation, and then some of the hardware decisions that were made this year. It's just I like using Motorola phones. I like their software experience. The Motorola Edge from last year was just one of my favorite phones to use, not for logical or objective reasons. I just kind of enjoy their devices and they're made well. But from my perspective, it seems like they kind of got lazy this year, and that's reflected with some of the way these devices turned out.
So a week from today, January 14th, Samsung announces the Galaxy S21. We know a lot about these phones. We know that there will be three of them, the Galaxy S21, S21 Plus, S21 Ultra. We know that they will also be announced with the Galaxy Buds Pro, which have not only leaked, but somebody was able to buy a pair of them off Facebook Marketplace last week and has put up multiple videos on YouTube. It's not even a secret. So we'll have tons of coverage around that next week. For now, it's exactly as you expected. These are very iterative updates. It seems like the major design tenets are that the camera is an extension of the frame. So the camera modules are covered with metal and are wrapped.
I still hate that design. It's looks gonna be so ugly.
A durability nightmare, I think, but we'll have to see. Rumors have it that at least one of them, if not all three of them, will support the S Pen, that some of them will ship with a case where you can use the S Pen like you would a note and you won't ever have to buy a note again if that's your thing. They may also ship basically a tile competitor where you can attach it to your keychain or put it on in your wallet or whatever and be able to find your keys and track it with a new Samsung app.
Attach it to that S Pen since there's no slot in the phone.
Oh, I'm willing to bet they would build it into the pen.
I don't know. We'll see. I maybe not, but it will be interesting to see what they come out with. Other rumors include on the Ultra, there will be two telephoto cameras, one 3X and one 10X. And I'm very excited about an actual 10X optical zoom on a Samsung phone. So looking forward to that. And obviously, price is the big question mark here. The Galaxy S20 series was considered overpriced, especially the entry-level Galaxy S20 at $1,000. With the economy as it is, with everything that's happening, most people aren't going to be interested in buying a small phone for $1,000. So Samsung probably has to drop that base level price. What are we going to lose going from $1,000 to $900 or whatever the price ends up being? Samsung will likely make some concessions. So lots to find out next week. We'll have that entire announcement ready for you on the Thursday. Come back and listen to that. So we're not going to touch on too much more of the Samsung stuff. We may have an emergency episode next week, depending on how much stuff launches early Monday, Tuesday at CES. We'll have to decide then. But for now, we're going to move right to what's making us happy. So let's go to Joe, because I saw exactly what's making you happy over the break. I saw you tweet about it many, many times. What is making you happy this week?
I know this might not get support from you, because I know you're the coffee aficionado will probably scoff at this, but my parents got my wife and I a Keurig K Cafe, which we had the Keurig K Mini, which is like their cheapest, smallest machine where you just fill up the water every single time and brew coffee that way. This has like the reservoir in it. You can choose your drink size and choose if you want it strong or not. But what's really fun is that it has a built-in milk frother, so you can depending on the amount of milk you put in it, you can make a latte or a macchiato. But I'm a very much a simpleton when it comes to my coffee desires. I'm the latte macchiato kind of person. I'm not, I guess, into real coffee, if you want to call it that. But
give it 6 months. My parents bought one of those, and yeah. Now it's like, oh, they froth the almond milk. They have hazelnut syrup. They have a special hazelnut syrup that they use in their coffee.
Are you trying to kill Daniel? Stop.
Yeah, I'm really holding back real hard right now.
He's probably got veins throbbing in his head ready to turn into the Hulk.
I've had them in my neck since I saw Joe's first tweet about it, but I didn't want to make him feel bad.
I know it disappoints you, but I put my pumpkin spice pot in there. I frost
the
milk.
I'm unplugging my headphones.
It makes I know it's not good, but it makes my simple heart and taste buds happy. So
you're a basic man. I love you.
Oh yeah.
I embrace it.
You're good. You love it.
Yeah. I acknowledge this is a controversial thing to like with the group.
It's not.
Here,
look,
but
good coffee is completely subjective.
Hey, look, at least you drink coffee. I don't. I know I am the outcast there.
You're fine. You also drink a ton of caffeinated beverages. So
yes, I do.
I just support the ingestion of caffeine. I'm that guy. I'm the pusher man. But I started out with, you know, my espresso journey was with a Nespresso machine. I got one for my wedding and I used it for 4 years or 5 years intermittently because I didn't always like it. But I used it and I enjoyed what I made and I eventually found a recipe that I liked. And then I bought an actual espresso machine and now I am completely addicted to that. So it's a slippery slope. Good luck with that.
I've seen pictures of it. I'm jealous of your espresso machine. I have dreams where I commit adultery with it.
I mean, mine isn't even that expensive. Mine was
doesn't matter. It's
mine is like $700. You can get $5,000 espresso machines that are like friends of the pod, Chris Davies, who you may know from Slash Gear. He is as well a coffee aficionado, but he went the logical step because he doesn't have a child to support. He spent $5,000 on an espresso machine and a grinder. And whenever I see photos of that machine, I want to murder him and steal it.
I've got a killer grinder.
Yeah. Chris lives fairly close to me. I messaged him and told him once this whole pandemic is over and we are vaccinated and healthy, I am driving over there ASAP to have him make me endless drinks.
Well,
with
I
that
think the law says if you drink Keurig coffee, you don't get vaccinated.
I mean, there's nothing stopping you from driving over there and just having him leave it on the porch for you. You don't need to be in front of a person to drink good coffee.
That's an excuse now.
I'm giving you a hard time, but I mean, I have a Black & Decker coffee maker that bolts underneath my countertop, and I just drink black coffee out of it, and I would probably really enjoy one of your macchiato extra frosty Wendy's pumpkin spice.
Whatever gets you off, guys. Candy that's things, all that yeah. matters. Seriously.
As long as you have enough caffeine to get through the day.
Yeah, as long as you can do your job. That's all that matters to me. All right, Jerry, what's making you happy this week?
Dude, I got an Amazon gift card for Christmas, and I bought one of those Furbos with it. And my dog is an idiot. It is so much fun. It is so much fun. I put it in the other room. And it has learned the little sound. So she's sitting in here beside me and I'll hit the button and that little thing will start up and she'll run out over there. She'll dance. She'll like wave her paws up in the air and do all sorts of gymnastics to get some nasty dried little treat thrown out. And then she takes that treat, runs it right back in here and shows it to me and eats it. And
that's amazing.
You know, 10 minutes later, I can do it all over again. It is the best way to entertain yourself and possibly torture your pets all together at the same time. But in the end, she gets little treats, so she loves it. And I love it. And I used to think they were too expensive. They're like $120, but they're not. If you have a dog, you just stop, hit pause on your podcast player, open up the Amazon app, and just buy one because trust Uncle Jerry, your dogs will just go batshit crazy over this thing. They will love it.
I've never heard of this, but I think I absolutely need to get Damon one because I think he would love something like this.
It's got a camera and it shoots treats out of a little hole.
Yeah, it's basically like a Nest Cam for dogs. Nest Cam with a projectile in it.
Yeah, he would go crazy over something like this.
And you can put small steel ball bearings in it, and it will shoot them out too. But then you have to try to keep your dog from putting it in their mouth. So I quickly learned, don't do that.
Yeah, moving on from dog abuse. Let's go. No, I mean I considered it, but it's not a good tool. It's not a good purchase for big dogs because it only shoots out tiny little pebbles.
Right. Yeah, so they're the size of your thumbnail.
Yeah,
I have a
Shih Tzu. They're for tiny, happy dogs.
Right, right. It's more fun just to watch her dance in front of it for 15 minutes.
Whatever gets you off, Jerry. All right, Ara, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I'm making another 1,000-mile drive this weekend, so I'm going to be happy to be back at home, happy to be back at Disney for a little while. But what's really making me happy is since I came home, I could restock on my favorite soda for my trip back. So whenever I get back, I'm going to have like 3 or 4 weeks worth of HEB Pure Cane Sugar Cola to
Wait,
keep myself
this?
Caffeinated.
Does Amazon have it?
No. HEB is the grocery it's the grocery store in Texas. It's one of the large, I want to say it's one of the largest employers or one of the larger employers in the state, but it's HEB is the grocery store chain down here. It's what we go to instead of going to Walmart if we can help it. But they have their own versions of everything, but they have regular sodas and then they have pure cane sugar sodas. And I love them because their normal price is $3 for a 12 pack. So they're a quarter a can for a pure cane sugar soda instead of having something with high fructose corn syrup in it.
So it's like Mexican Coke. I love Mexican Coke.
Yeah.
Not Only that it's made kind, in Texas. Daniel. Stop.
Mm-hmm.
But I get to stock up on that, and I get to stock up on my Slayton Bakery vanilla wafers, and then I got to drive 19 hours.
This is a food-related what's making us happy. I think we all need the comfort. I mean, one isn't personally food, but it's dog food.
If we want to really get into it, since I've been home, I've been able to have like key lime. I've been able to have key lime soft serve while I've been home. We made potato rolls. We made kolaches. I need to make cookies so that way I can eat them on my drive back to Florida.
You know, Joe can get my favorite soda, but I can't. Wishniac. That cherry stuff that every store in Central Michigan sells that stuff, man.
Wishniac?
Yeah. It's
honestly
cherry
never heard
soda.
Of that.
Well,
I was going to say, is that a soda or some kind of a curse word? Because that sounds amazing.
It's a cherry soda, and I love it. And the only place I've ever found it for sale was maybe not Central Michigan, Southern Michigan. You know where Hell is? Yes, that's a real town.
Yes, mm-hmm. It is.
Hell, and then across the border from Toledo, right around there is where I used to get it. Whenever
I assume you're
going to
say like
area.
Fago or Verner's or something. No, I've never heard of this one.
Verner's, I still have that taste in my mouth, and that was 25 years ago.
It'll do that to you.
I want to try some of this HEB cane sugar generic soda. I just don't want to go to Texas for it. Era?
I mean, I wouldn't mind swinging by you, Jerry, but this is kind of a busy week for me to be doing an extra 8 hours of driving.
Can you put just one can in the mail?
I could probably package up a few cans and send it to you.
Please don't send him cola in the mail. That's not going to end well. Jerry's going to get it out and open it, and it's going to blow off his head, and then we're never going to hear from him again.
I didn't think of that. See, that's why.
No, it's just a matter of after you get the package, you have to take out the cans and let them sit in the fridge for like 5 days to let all of the bubbles settle.
No, put it in the freezer. Nothing bad will happen. Trust me.
No.
I like the way you think, Daniel.
Only put the soda in this freezer for an hour, and then when you take it out and pour it into a frosted mug, you get an icy.
Daniel, can you get Mexican soda in Canada, or are your...
Probably.
Are your drinks made with sugar in the first place, or...
No, they're all made with sugar. We don't... None of the Coke products, very few of the products here use high fructose corn syrup.
Okay, but you have tasted the nasty kind made with corn syrup.
Oh, yeah. I've visited the U.S. Yeah. before.
So you can see why we thirst after this.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same reason, like, British chocolate is so much better than North American chocolate because they use better quality cocoa butter, and you always yearn for, like, the chocolate that you can't buy.
The little Kinder eggs, we're not allowed to have them.
I'm very hungry now.
All because I choked on the little prize.
Then my job is done, Joe. I'm hungry too.
Yeah, let's finish this off.
I had most of a Coke I was
going to
drink, and then we said we were podcasting, and I left it in the kitchen.
All right, well, we'll finish it off. What's making me happy this week is kind of sacrilege, I guess, if you listen to this show, but it's Apple Fitness Plus. So I got a trial version of this, put it on my Apple Watch and my iPhone. Been using it for various workout types lately, and it's super impressive. The interaction between the Apple Watch and whatever display you're working on, it doesn't matter if it's like an Apple TV on your television or an iPad or your iPhone, it shows you your beats per minute. It shows you how hard you're working. It shows you how you're doing in comparison to the average person who does that workout. The quality of the workouts are pretty good, right? If you're like a pro, they probably won't be very hard. But for somebody who, you know, doesn't really cross train or anything, this is perfectly difficult for somebody like me who's new to high intensity interval training or you know, going hard on the bike using intervals, things like that. I really have no complaints. They've all been really fun. The music decisions, you can like filter by music type. So I've been doing a lot of hip hop bikes, which has been really fun. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't recommend buying an Apple Watch or an iPhone just to use Apple Fitness Plus. But if you have those things, you can try it out for free. I think there's a week long trial and I would recommend it. It might kind of get you jump-started, which is a good excuse for January when we're all kind of down and inside.
I've been really tempted to give it a shot because what we usually use here for like a workout app, there's one called FitOn, which is like completely free to use. Like they've got good workouts and everything, but the Apple Watch integration is always super flaky just because third-party workout apps with Apple Watch aren't always the best. So the idea of having something that integrates properly, just because it's obviously a first party thing with a display and everything, has been super, super appealing. So I might have to give that trial a shot and see how it goes.
Yeah, I definitely recommend it.
Are there plenty of upper body strength training workouts like, say, a man in a wheelchair could do, like weightlifting and stuff?
There are core much of that workouts, Jerry, but I don't think any of them are accessible. No.
Because I've got an Apple TV sitting here that just doesn't get used, and I get the emails about my free trial since I bought that iPhone SE. And I just was wondering if it would be a companion while I was lifting weights. That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, I don't think so, but I'm sure of any company, you know, to do it, it'll probably be Apple. So.
Well, that's why I asked, because, right, if any company's going to do it, it's going to be Apple. And then everybody else will rush to try to copy it and do it poorly.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're going to be back next week. Sorry we were gone so long. I want to thank everybody for sending really, you know, I got some really nice emails over the break just saying thank you for the podcast, which means a lot. It's great that we can provide a bit of comfort and spend some time with you. So I hope everybody had a really safe and happy Christmas and New Year season. Hope everybody's okay, back to work, and is ready to join us for a really exciting 2021. So Jerry, Ara, Joe, thank you. And we'll see you next week. Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Adios.
Bye.